I rode with old Jeb Stuart and his band of Southern horse. There never were no Yankees who could beat us force to force. No, they never did defeat us, but we never could evade their dirty foreign politics and cowardly blockade. Well, we hadn't any powder and we hadn't any shot. We hadn't any money to buy what we ain't got. So we rode our worn-out horses and we ate on plain cornmeal. And we licked them where we caught them with Southern guts and steel. Well, we sunk the ship at Sumter and we broke her plumb in two.
That's right.
And we showed them bully Yankees just what we aim to do. At a little creek called Bull Run, we took the starry rag to wipe our horses down with, and I ain't here to brag. Well, there aren't as many left of us as rode out at the start. And then there are
the
weak and body sad of heart. We fought a fight.
Welcome, everyone, to Rebel Madman Radio here on the 7th day of October in the year of 2023. And my sincere apologies to the wonderful memory of Waylon Jennings for interrupting that fantastic song. And folks, we got a little background music, background noise there, but we're good. And I just wanted to let everyone know to get us all started. Number one, before we jump into the program today, which I am so excited to have the guests that we have today, such a wealth of knowledge. But before we jump into that, folks, free speech is not free. That's a misnomer. The government claims they give us free speech, but they don't. That is a trap. That is rat trap. You think you have it and you don't. But if you stick your head in there, you'll get it knocked off. But anyway, folks, you need to step up. We need to support RBN, and as a platform for bringing us or allowing us to bring programs such as we have today. And so I would ask you to go to republicbroadcasting.org and hit that donate button. And, you know, if you can't do that, you know, dial 1-800-724-2719 or extension 3, and they can take care of you, and it will certainly be appreciated. And, you know, just help us keep this platform going, because after you listen to my wonderful guest today, you're going to understand how important this is. And speaking of that wonderful guest, I have with me today the owner, operator of Patriot Tours in New York City, none other than Karen Quinones herself. And folks, this is just, we are in for such a treat. Karen, how are you today, lady?
I'm great, Mike, and it is really so good to be back. Your listeners are so fantastic. I heard from so many people after the last time I was on the show, and so I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to have a great time.
Well, fantastic, lady, and I hope I don't, you know, I always wonder about messing up the pronunciation of your last name. Did I get that correctly, or did I butcher it?
That is correct. It's Quinones.
Oh, well, thank you, my dear. Thank you so very much. And, you know, we have communicated some since the last program. I also have gotten, you know, and last night doing the class that I do with the folks in Colorado and, you know, South Dakota and other places out west, you know, that was a lot of talk today about your last program here with me and the fact that you were going to be back today. So, yes, we have a lot of people who are interested in this. And, Karen, we all know, you know, through our, communist-mandated education, that Abraham Lincoln invaded the South. We know that. But how many people know that Abraham Lincoln invaded the North? as well. So the Civil War was not a war between the states. It was a war against the states by the federal government. Would you elaborate on that for me, please, ma'am?
I will, and it was. And, you know, a little bit of background about New York that your listeners probably don't know, in order to make this whole make sense, because New York is a weird place and always has been, is really brief. I just want to go back to one of your favorite subjects, the United States Constitution. All of the trouble in New York in the Civil War begins with the Constitutional Convention and Alexander Hamilton, who, you may know, did not have permission to throw out the Articles of Confederation and create a new document. He was one of three of our delegates to that convention. The other was John Lansing and Robert Yates, two great men who are completely ignored in New York history now. No students of history in New York have ever heard of these two men. They've only heard of Hamilton, and they became staunch anti-federalists. They were against the getting rid of the Articles of Confederation. They were against federal power, as they feared that federal power would be used against the autonomy of the states. And when it comes to New York, this is such an important thing to understand, that from our founding in 1625 as a Dutch colony, New York has always wanted to be left alone and to leave everyone else alone. This was always our policy before the Civil War. Look, we're our thing, you're your thing. If we can cooperate and make money together, that's great. Otherwise, we're not going to tell you how to live, and we don't want you to tell us how to live. And we especially felt that way about, you know, the Yankees in New England up there, that they should leave us alone. And so Judge Yates and Judge Lansing are going to argue vehemently against ratification of the Constitution. But as you know, the Constitution will get ratified. They are going to be behind, you know, the only thing they can think of to do, and that is to force some amendments. And so we get the Bill of Rights to try to push back on that feared federal power. And many of the things in the Bill of Rights were already in existence in New York prior to the Revolutionary War. So that just gives us some background about what's going on in New York. So after the Revolutionary War and the Constitution, New York continues to grow. And New York is doing great, right? We've got the Erie Canal, we've got the steamship, men are being educated, small businesses are growing, and we get the beginnings of what you call a middle class. Farmers are expanding through upstate New York, there's prosperity and education, and really that idea in New York is continuing that, look, we're New York. You guys are yourselves. You do what you want to do, and we're going to do what we want to do. And then the issue of slavery comes up. Some New Yorkers are abolitionists, and they're against slavery. Some New Yorkers are neutral on slavery. They don't own slaves. They don't make money in the slave trade, but they don't think the Southerners' business is theirs and that this is an issue the South ought to solve on their own. And of course, there are New Yorkers who are making a lot of money on the slave trade. And of course, they're going to favor the South as well. But still, New York is not really getting involved in this. New York's idea is still, okay, we're factionalized. We have these, you know, differences of opinion, and leave us alone and we'll leave you alone. And we kind of stay that way until the Republican Party forms. And then we have big problems in New York. By the way, New York did not fully abolish slavery until 1829. So any idea that New Yorkers were going to war over slaves is largely untrue. We had only just abolished our own slaves, so slavery was not the issue for New York. It was other reasons to support the war. So this power struggle continues, and as I mentioned, we get the Republican Party. And another strange thing about New York that's important to understand is that we always, to this day, have a struggle between power. Who runs New York? Does our state government in Albany run New York City? Or does New York City run New York City? I know this probably sounds crazy to all of you out there, but we still have aspects of our city government that are run by our state government. Most important today would be education and transportation, but there are other things as well. In 1854, a Democrat named Fernando Wood was elected mayor. He was the first Tammany Democrat to become mayor, and he was part of this movement to plan and make New York grow, right? His view was, I'm mayor, it's my job to make the city great. And from Fernando Wood, we get things like Central Park, the grid street system, a water system, sewage system, order. Fernando Wood believed in order, law and order, cleanliness, making the city a great city. But he was a Democrat. He was really popular with, nativists, and he was opposed to the free soil movement, you know, that was against expansion of slavery into the territories. He thought they ought to decide themselves. And he was very popular nationally. They actually called him the model mayor because he was a planner and a good administrator. And then, of course, we get a Republican legislature. Fernando Wood served a term, then he was out of office, then he was back in office. And during his second term in office, the Republican legislature actually revised our New York City charter to get him out of office after just one term. It truncated his time in office. It also dissolved the police force that Fernando Wood commanded and created a new police force that the governor commanded and the Republican legislature commanded. This led to a massive riot. When Mayor Wood would not allow this new police force to take its place, the governor issued an arrest warrant for him. 1,000 New York City police officers surrounded the city hall. The new police officers arrived, about 1,000 of them, and they had a huge riot over this. Lasted all day. You know, law and order was just gone throughout the city. Mayhem reigned in the city. And the Republican legislature called the National Guard to come in and arrest Fernando, which they did. Fernando Wood was arrested the same day he was released, and no further charges were ever brought against him, nor did he have a trial. And this, of course, made him have to leave office. So we get another mayor, and then in 1860, Fernando Wood is back. And he's identified as a copperhead, you know, the guys in the North who were against going to war with the South. He's also against what he calls in New York the Black Republicans. I don't know if this phrase was used outside of New York, but the Lincoln-supporting Republicans were always called Black Republicans. And they were depicted in newspapers as African-looking, so the Black Republicans. And Fernando Wood said, and I really want to share this quote with you because it's such an important and timely quote. He said, "Until we have provided and cared for the oppressed laboring man in our own midst, we should not extend our sympathy to the laboring man of other states." And he goes on to say that if Abraham Lincoln is elected and he goes to war against the states of America, New York City will secede. We'll declare ourselves a free and independent city because we don't support this unconstitutional war against the states. So this is Fernando Wood, of course, making all kinds of trouble for the Republicans. And after his statement on secession, Fernando Wood was removed from the mayoralty once again. And he might, as you may know, he went on to serve in the Congress, and he was very much a side in the thorn of President Lincoln. So the first time we see, you know, Republican power interfering in the government of New York is that arrest of the mayor, Fernando Wood. You know, what right did they have to come in and arrest a sitting mayor simply because he wouldn't agree to have his government dissolved? So that is an outrage. That is an outrage. And Fernando Wood and the whole Tammany structure, of course, in history today is remembered very badly as, you know, corrupt and awful and horrible. But that's really not, you know, the entirety of what they are. Because Fernando Wood's police department was removed, a huge riot occurred in New York that same year, 1857, between two gangs. It's shown in the movie. Oh, what's the movie? Gangs of New York.
And it's Gangs of New York. Yes, ma'am.
Right. It's the riot between the Dead Rabbits and the Bowery Boys. You know, had Fernando Wood remained in office as mayor, that would have never occurred. You know, that riot would have never occurred. That was a direct result of the militia being called up by the Republican governor to arrest the Democrat, freely elected sitting mayor of New York. So this is our first outrage, right? So this is our first outrage. And New Yorkers largely were not in favor of this war. We didn't see it as our business. Many of the newspapers, as you know, in New York said it was unconstitutional. And the newspapers that did say it was unconstitutional and were against it were badgered by Lincoln, right? Lincoln had this like equivalent of a press secretary that he sent to New York to intimidate the publishers. I think it was The World and The Sun. There might have been another one.
Correct.
Who were against Correct. The war. You know, he actually sent this team of guys here to intimidate them about what they were publishing. And luckily, he didn't jail any of them, but he did jail other publishers. So this is kind of what's going on in New York during the war. And of course, once the money in New York realized there was more money to be made, first financing Lincoln's war, right? Because Lincoln needed money for the war. So, you know, let's have the bankers from New York finance the war and get some interest on this. So now New York's kind of like, well, maybe we might like the idea of this war after all. You know, we're going to profit on this. And the factories are going to do great as well. So the factories are going to have to make everything. So suddenly now New York's politicians and leaders are all in favor of this war because the war will make money for them, more money for them than the illicit cotton trade at that time. So now we're all gung-ho in favor of the war. So I ask people, I used to do a Civil War tour that I stopped doing, but I used to ask people on my Civil War tour, if people in the North or in New York were so in favor of going to war to free the slaves, which is what we all learn in school. I learned that in school. I went, you know, I'll be candid here. I went to all Northeastern elitist schools, so I'll just admit that up front. You know, that is what I learned and studied and was taught. So if people really believed in that, why did Lincoln need a draft? Why did he have to draft people in New York? Why were they dragging brand new Irish immigrants right off of the boats as they arrived and forcing them to serve? And why could you buy your way out if you were wealthy? You know, if everyone was so happy to go fight, why did all of these things have to happen? Because people weren't happy to go fight. And here in New York, they did not want to go fight. And other places in the North, you know, they viewed it as an unconstitutional use of federal power that Judge Yates and Lansing warned us about in 1788 would one day happen. It was exactly what they warned, and now it was happening right in front of everyone. I should also add, and you probably know more about this than I do, that during the debate over the Constitution, Lansing, Yates, and others were against a standing army. And it was not because they were against defense of the nation. It was because they feared federal power and the use of that standing army against the states. And I think you probably know much more about that aspect than I do.
Well, Karen, I have a question, and this is something in my studies, and thank you for that. What a great description. Thank you so very much for that, because I'm sure most people have never heard of that. But I, you know, one of the things that I learned in my research is that early on with the Republican Party, which was founded primarily by communists in Ripon, Wisconsin, I probably mispronounced that, in 1854. But the Republican Party very quickly realized that they could not control New York City. So they decided instead to control the capital, which was Albany.
Right.
Now, does that make sense to your understanding?
Yeah, that is pretty much, you know, exactly what's going on. Also keep in mind that the anti-federalists, Lansing, Yates, and all of those guys, are in Albany. And
right.
The Federalists are down here in the city. So Hamilton's guys are down here. Well, with the exception, you know, of Aaron Burr and a number of other great men who were also anti-Federalists. Most of them were hardcore up in Albany. And the Federalists were down here. So, you know, as we get into the 1850s and the establishment of the Republican Party, you know, obviously they're going to go after Albany and try to subdue Albany. Because their enemies are up there, and then set their sights on independent New York City.
Well, Karen, here's a question, and you know, you're very much into New York history, and I don't want to jump the subject, but here is something that has been in my mind for so many years. And are you familiar with the fate of John Lansing Jr.?
You know, I'm not.
Well, did you know that as, you know, he was not only an attorney, he was not only a judge on the Supreme Court of New York, but he eventually became the Chief Justice.
Right.
But sometime later in his life, John Lansing Jr. left his law office and went to the post office to mail a letter and was never seen or heard from again.
Wow.
And he just disappeared. And, of course, you know, you have alluded to the fact that he and Robert Yates, and, of course, most people don't know that there were three delegates from New York that were chosen to attend the Constitutional Convention, and that was Robert Yates, John Lansing Jr., and Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton pushed hard to get John Jay in that group, but the people of New York would not go for it. And so then when once John Lansing Jr. and Robert Yates left the Constitutional Convention, New York had not a vote because the quorum was gone. And so
right.
Hamilton
and you know,
Hamilton
there were,
left. Go ahead. I'm sorry, ma'am.
You know,
I'm sorry.
And you know, there was, I should mention him, you know, their friend, Isaac Ledyard, also who had even leading up to the Constitutional Convention in a series of pamphlets as mentor, was already debating Hamilton on these issues before there was even a Constitutional Convention called, right? They were already talking about, you know, changing the Articles of Confederation, and Hamilton had written a series of pamphlets about the way he thought they should be changed, and the brave Isaac Ledyard, you know, responded to him that, you know, this is just a boy, this is a kid, he doesn't know anything, he's never done anything except, you know, sit on Washington's staff, and now here he is telling all of us, you know, what we should do and how we should do it. You know, this is a joke, and why are we listening to this kid? So, you know, another colleague of theirs that early on saw Hamilton as a problem, you know, going forward for New York.
Oh, very much so. And how many people, you know, are familiar with the fact that starting last year, last August, as a matter of fact, in 2022, the Jewish community claimed Alexander Hamilton as a Jew.
Yeah,
any thoughts on that?
You know, everybody's claiming Hamilton now. I have a lot of issue with the fact that the only person from New York from the entire American Revolutionary War period who is remembered is Alexander Hamilton. You know, this is a really, really troubling thing. And, you know, there were big names years before Hamilton was born who were already fighting in New York for the kind of, you know, rights that later those anti-federalists would fight for, and they were fighting against England for them, you know, freedom of association, you know, no government, you know, interference in religion, freedom of the press, you know, not being able to be arrested because a politician didn't like what you wrote. You know, all of these kinds of things were being battled in New York long before Hamilton was born. And by the time Hamilton came to New York, you know, the debate in New York was already hot and heavy against England. You know, there were already highly established men here who already were writing and who were very popular. And Hamilton was just, you know, one of those younger writers leading up to the war. Of course, during the war, he served on Washington's staff. And then after the war, he returned as a young lawyer. And then through many of his political contacts and whatever, really was an advocate for himself and managed to thrust himself into the forefront of all of this debate. And of course, you know, he even turned on some of his early benefactors, like the Livingstons. Probably the most famous was him, you know, turning against the Livingstons, who became anti-federalists, most of them, turning
right.
against George Clinton, who was an anti-federalist. And so Hamilton gets remembered today as this guy who, like, you know, got New York to turn against England, were victorious in all these battles in the Revolutionary War, and he didn't really have that much battle experience until the very end of the war. And then, single-handedly became the greatest lawyer in New York, started the banking system, and that's a whole other bad subject to talk about, his banking.
Oh, yes.
His banking stories. He's brilliant. He got us the United States Constitution. You know, Hamilton single-handedly started America, right? He ran Washington's administration for him. You know, all of this stuff Hamilton supposedly did. And because of that, all of these great men have either fallen by the wayside or have been absolutely demonized and remembered completely as they were not. And let's take Aaron Burr as an example of that. Aaron Burr, or, who else do they really demonize from the time, who was a really, prominent anti-federalist in New York? I think most people just know about Burr. But again, there was Isaac Ledyard and a number of them, other ones. Most people don't know that Washington Irving, the writer, who everyone knows this time of year for Sleepy Hollow and the Headless Horseman, the whole Irving right. family, very powerful family, they were anti-federalist and anti-Hamiltonians as well. They were all Burrites. The whole family. So nobody remembers any of that, right? So we have this, since we have this completely warped Hamilton history, this leads into a completely warped Civil War history, right? Because if your foundation is bad, everything you're going to build on that foundation will also be bad.
Well, Karen, two things stick in my mind as I think about this. There were two anti-federalists who predicted the Civil War would occur if the Constitution was ratified. And number one was Patrick Henry from Virginia, who refused to attend the Constitutional Convention because he said he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia. And then, we talk about the forgotten people, and you're talking about in New York, Yates and Lansing are forgotten. That is a shame of infinitesimal value that those two men are forgotten. But then let's not forget that Luther Martin is also forgotten.
That's right.
Who predicted not only the what we call the Civil War, he not only predicted that, but he also predicted Reconstruction. And of course we know that somewhere in New York, Luther Martin is buried in an unmarked grave, which has been paved over for a parking lot.
Reconstruction, wasn't that the first Build Back Better?
Yes, that was the Build Back Better model or prototype, if we will. But yeah, Karen, this is so wonderful that you're able to lend all of these points to exactly the truth of history, which, why is the truth covered up? And I know we're coming up on a break here pretty soon, but why is the truth covered up? And I remember very distinctly 1982, walking up to the curator in the National Archives and asking that curator if these microfiche that I were looking at were accurate. And they stated, yes, they are accurate. And I said, but they go totally against everything I have ever been taught in high school or college. And I'll never forget the curator looking at me and said, well, why do people lie? Now, we've got a break coming up, Karen. I can't wait to get back to you on the other side. And, thanks for opening up so many windows for us here, because the listeners need to know the truth.
Absolutely.
We really need to know the truths of history. And here's our music. We'll be back on the other side. Folks, get to republicbroadcasting.org and smash that donate button. Thank you. We'll be back.
The truth. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
Hey there, are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new Ease-Off drop-in lift?
What in the world is an Ease-Off drop-in lift?
Our Ease-Off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the Ease-Off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my Ease-Off?
Go to easeoff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. Ease-Off.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
Ease-Off, LLC, 417-932-6419.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, Sierra Madre Precious Metals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
How hard it is for me to interrupt that great Arkansas Confederate, LeVon Helm, and his rendition there of "The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down." I tell you what, I could listen to that song for hours on end. And if you haven't, if you really want to see the passion that LeVon Helm put into this song, go to YouTube and bring it up, The Last Dance, and watch the passion that this man puts out there, and the fact that the song was written by his fellow band's member, Robbie, who did this, Robbie Robertson, who did this after visiting with LeVon Helm and his parents, and they talked about their Confederate ancestry. That is the origin of this song. But don't let me take a moment away from our wonderful guest here, Karen Quinones. And Karen, would you continue, please? You were telling me some great stuff during the break there, and my heart is palpitating at the anticipation.
All right. Well, one of the things I like to ask people on my tour, I do too a tour about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, comparing and contrasting the two men and their views and everything. And one of the things I like to ask on that tour is I ask people, why were the Federalist Papers written? You know, because we learn about them in school. Oh, the Federalist Papers this, the Federalist Papers that. But nobody ever learns about why they were written. All we learn is, oh, they were written to encourage the states to ratify the Constitution. Well, by the time the Federalist Papers were written, most of the states had already ratified the Constitution. So the Federalist Papers were aimed specifically at one state, and that was New York, because the New York Anti-Federalists were so eloquent in their criticisms of the Constitution that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay had to respond to the criticisms. The criticisms could not go unanswered. They were reasonable criticisms, and they were interesting and intelligent criticisms, and they had to be answered. So the Federalist Papers are an answer to the Anti-Federalist Papers. And I always encourage everyone, if you're going to, you know, sit down and read any of the Federalist Papers, you should read the articles they're a response to. Because you're only getting one side, right? You're just getting the propaganda of why the Constitution is so fabulous. But you're not getting the question that prompted the answer. So I just suggest to everybody that you take a look at those sometime, you know, if you have the chance, because then that will give you more of the debate that was going on at the time.
If I may interject here, and I'm pardon me for interrupting, but one of the things especially, and to your point, was especially the Federalist Papers in the 60s, the 60-numbered Federalist Papers, were written directly by Alexander Hamilton in response to Brutus in his Anti-Federalist Papers, who was none other than Robert Yates.
So here drove Hamilton crazy.
Yes, and this is something, and your recommendation is perfect. Because I try to tell my students, if you're going to read the Federalist Papers, especially the, you know, 60s, the one in the numbers of 60s that were written by Alexander Hamilton, please go back and read Brutus and his essays so you will see who is responding to whom.
Exactly.
So thank you for that, Karen.
And also something people also don't always know today, because our government education is so poor, unfortunately, is that, you know, when they used a pseudonym, they used it for a reason. And Brutus was one of the men who overthrew the monarchy to establish the Roman Republic. So there's a reason Judge Yates is using the name Brutus against Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton knew that. You know, they're pretty smart guys.
Most definitely. And and most people are unaware, Karen, that, you know, right after the Articles of Confederation was ratified in 1781, no one saw the peril that that would bring to the Federalist monarchist more than Alexander Hamilton. And so to the New York legislature in 1782, less than a year after the ratification, Alexander Hamilton is calling for a new convention and a new constitution.
Exactly, and that's what Isaac Ledyard is debating him. And
yes,
Isaac Ledyard exactly. Actually uses the name Mentor because he's an older, more successful gentleman trying to mentor this youth in the ways of the world. So, you know, even his pseudonym against Hamilton is quite good. I forgot the pseudonym Hamilton used in those debates. I can find it. I'm sure it's equally good.
Pacificus.
Was that what he used?
Used Pacificus on several occasions, yes.
Oh, he used Phocion.
Yes, he used that as well.
He used Phocion. Right, and Ledger just says, well, then I'm a mentor. I'm your mentor. You know, it's really, I really am a fan of Isaac Ledger. I went to visit his grave in Staten Island, did a wonderful little video at his grave, thanking him for his service to us. But he's totally forgotten as well, right? I'm sure none of your, I wonder how many people in the audience, you know, maybe in the question and answer session, can let us know how many of them have heard of Isaac Ledyard or Robert Yates or John Lansing or Samuel Bryant, right?
Right.
The guys writing these anti-federalist papers. George Clinton. I wonder how many of them have even heard of them.
Oh, very, very few, I promise you, because they have been indoctrinated, not educated.
In the government schools. So in the government schools,
yes.
You know, we learned the government view of things, right? So, you know, so back to the Civil War. So we learn in school. And when I was a girl growing up in school, we had to watch Roots. And then I think in my 20s, Ken Burns I don't want to use the word documentary, his propaganda documentary, The Civil War, came out.
Thank you.
And I was only in my 20s when I saw that. And of course, like everyone else, I thought it was really wonderful. And then, you know, after I actually became educated in history, you know, my husband and I sat down to watch it some years ago. We couldn't even get 15 minutes into it. It was so outrageous. You know, we just couldn't even watch it anymore. So we're all indoctrinated in this propaganda about the Civil War. But the Civil War, largely on the part of New York and the North and the, you know, industrialists, was, like most wars, it was about money. It was about expanding industrialism and making money. And, you know, Fernando Wood even talked about that. So after we kick Fernando Wood out of New York, I mentioned he goes on to serve in the Congress. So Fernando Wood's going to be in the Congress. And in 1868, he gets up to talk about Reconstruction, and he calls it a monstrosity. He says a measure the most infamous of the many infamous acts of this infamous Congress. And they voted to censure him for that. Incredible. They voted to censure him for that. We skipped over the big invasion of New York, 1863, the draft riots. So,
oh, we got to cover that.
As I ask people, if everyone wanted to go free the slaves for moral reasons and to make us a better country and all of that good stuff, or for the people who believe that the Civil War was to keep the country united, or the Union has to stand no matter what, whatever, whichever thing people believe, I always say to them, well, then why did Lincoln need this draft? You know, why were they grabbing guys right off of ships arriving from Ireland and taking them away from their families to serve? A really horrendous thing to do. And why could you pay your way out if you were wealthy? And so we get these draft riots in New York in 1863. And these are the worst riots up until that point, worse than anything happened leading up to the Revolutionary War or anything like that. Horrible draft riots. And when you're in school, you learn the draft riots were racial riots, that they were racially motivated, that it was the Irish racially motivated against the black people in New York. And there was a racial element to the draft riots because there was a lot of racism at that time. I won't discount that. But it's not the reason. The draft riots are economic riots. They're economic riots that this, you know, industrialist nobility in New York, you know, their sons do go off to fight, but they go off and they command these elitist units, right? You know, they're a few of them are on the front line fighting because there's always a few men who are brave. But largely the sons are going off and, you know, they're, you know, commanders in these more elitist units. Or, you know, a father could simply pay, I think it was $300 or $500 for their son not to have to go. Or you could pay someone to go in your place. Tammany society was so outraged at people being dragged off of the boats, which meant new families arrived and had no one to support them, tried to pay a stipend to all of those families who lost their men. And even the Tammany organization couldn't raise enough money for that. So this is what really leads to the draft riots. A couple of things. First, the draft leads to the draft riots, obviously. But before that, also anger in New York over something called the Emancipation Proclamation, which no one educated in the North understands, and I never understood either. So we learn that in the Emancipation Proclamation, President Lincoln was this wonderful man, and he freed all of the slaves. Well, Lincoln could not free the slaves in the United States of America. It required a constitutional amendment, and that's why we got the amendment later, right? So we couldn't do it there. The Emancipation Proclamation was aimed at the states of the Confederacy because they no longer were under the United States Constitution. And it wasn't meant actually to free the slaves, but to cause chaos in the South. So, you know, it was represented as one thing, and it was something else. You know, it was a strategic move to cause chaos in the South and make Lincoln look like this great moral guy. And I would ask people also on my tour, if the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves, one, why were there still slave states in the North, which most people don't know? And secondly, why did we require a constitutional amendment? If an executive order freed them, then why did we need a constitutional amendment? So all of that kind of works together. This Emancipation Proclamation, which people in New York are saying, hey, that's unconstitutional. He can't do that. You know, that's unconstitutional. The war is unconstitutional. You know, people saying, why should I or my son go die in Lincoln's unconstitutional war? Oh, now you're going to draft my son and make him go die in this war. All of this winds up into these draft riots of 1863, which is all of this simmering hatred in New York that just explodes. Also remember, by 1863, New Yorkers were being really inundated with propaganda in the newspapers, right? At that time, the newspapers in the North, especially New England, but also in New York a couple, realized that the way to make money is to be controversial. And the way you could be really controversial was by degrading the South, right? Insulting the South every way you could think of. They're demonic. They're beastly, right? They even called Jefferson the spawn of Satan or something. You know, they're all demons down there. They support slavery. You know, we need to go down there and we need to kill every white slaveholder in the South. It's the only righteous and moral thing to do. And some of them hear this in their churches, you know, like Henry Ward Beecher and some of these other guys. So they're inundated with that propaganda on one side. And then on the other side, you know, there's the other side, you know, calling the New Englanders names. Oh, these fake abolitionists, you know, they want abolition, but they don't want any of these people in their states. You know, they just want to ship them back to Africa. So they're all liars up there. So got this going on. We've got immigrants, poor immigrants flooding in from Ireland, you know, who, you know, luckily for them, the war machine is going and they're getting jobs in the factories, at least the ones who are here and not shipped off to go fight in a war they have nothing to do with. All of that bubbles up into these massive riots. And when you see like who the targets of the rioting are, you understand it a little better. So some of the targets of the rioting are going to be black families on the part of Irish who are very racist. So yes, that happens. Yes, it is horrific and violent and disgraceful. But we look at what some of the other targets are, like Horace Greeley's newspaper, The Tribune, The New York Times, the pro-Lincoln newspapers are also targets of the draft rioters. And actually, you know, the guys in the Tribune and the Times went out and bought weapons. They came back with cartloads of weapons to arm the people inside of their buildings for when the rioters broke in so that they could shoot at them. Other targets, big targets, are going to be all of the wealthy New Yorkers who, you know, are profiting on the war or whose sons aren't serving in the war, right? So they're going to rampage along Fifth Avenue and all of those mansions, and they're going to, of course, loot them and burn some of them. So when we really look at the draft riots, you know, we can see, you know, that there are a number of targets of this anger. Well, the draft riots go on for 3 days. The governor of that time, the mayor at that time, is a Republican, George Updike, who was a Democrat. Then he became a free soiler, right, an abolitionist, and then he became a Republican. So he's the mayor now. The legislature is Republican. You know, their new police department that they created is totally ineffectual against the rioters. So what happens? The Republican mayor asks Abraham Lincoln to divert federal troops to New York to fire on the draft
riders. From Gettysburg.
Turned them around, yes, and brought them from Gettysburg to shoot civilian rioters in the city of New York. They went block to block. They lined up and shot them, and they piled the bodies up on the corners as a warning to the other rioters to put down their weapons.
Well, Karen, how many people are aware that of the members of the Union Army who were killed in the New York riots, the draft riots? How many people are aware that Lincoln had those men listed intentionally, not as casualties in New York, but as casualties of the Battle of Gettysburg?
Oh, I didn't know that, but I believe it.
Yes, he did. He made sure that any casualties, any Union soldier that died in New York putting down the riot, was listed as a casualty from Gettysburg.
Wow. You know, and the rioters, some of them were very well armed. You know, they broke into a number of armories, and then they barricaded themselves into large city blocks. They were pretty well organized, considering. And, you know, were shooting out of the buildings at the soldiers who were shooting at them.
Oh, very much so. So, and you mentioned the Emancipation Proclamation. This is something that most people are taught in school that, oh, okay, the great emancipator, he freed all the slaves. No, he did not. Even his Secretary of State from New York, Mr. Seward, asked the question, Mr. President, why do you free the slaves in the territories where you have no control, but keep the people in bondage where you do?
Good question.
That is something that, people look, say that to someone today and you get that deer in the headlights look. But even his own cabinet questioned, and he stipulated in the Emancipation Proclamation, in the very beginning, he says this is a war measure. But then let's also not forget if we want to talk about the hypocrisy of the whole mess, let's not forget for a second that Lincoln unconstitutionally, because he needs the electoral votes in 1864, he brings West Virginia into the Union. Again, unconstitutionally, Article 4, Section 4. He brings them into the Union as a slave state a year after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, you know, I can, you know, I'm sort of speechless, but, you know, like I said, this often just goes back to that whole Constitution issue where the men in New York who were skeptical of the Constitution had seen all kinds of trickery employed by the British Parliament. Remember, the American Revolution is about corruption in the British Parliament, right? So we always have to keep stepping back to see what was going on. And they were well aware of the trickery that would be used by a powerful centralized government, you know, like which the king and his lords did in the Parliament. So, you know, they warned that this type of, you know, trickery and deception and underhandedness would, of course, occur in any other type of federal power. And you know, the anti-federalists were really against a president. They really feared the potential growth of the office of the presidency.
Ah, Patrick Henry, when he said, away with your president, we will have a king.
Right, and right, Patrick Henry and James Madison became lifelong rivals over this, and Madison even wrote a Federalist paper at Patrick Henry, I think, on the presidency. And I think the Federalist paper might even be titled on the subject of the presidency.
Well, it is, and as a matter of fact, but their split happened many years before that. As a matter of fact, it occurred over Patrick Henry proposing a constitution for the state of Virginia that would be based on biblical principles only.
Oh, and rather of than course, Madison's Virginia plan?
Yes, Madison and Jefferson very much opposed that, and in a letter in 1784 from Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, Thomas Jefferson even says to Madison, we should pray fervently for the death of Patrick Henry.
Right, right. I remember that.
So it happens, you know, they want rid of him much before that. And then when Patrick Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention, James Madison expressed his fears of how this might play out in a letter to George Washington. And that is a letter I'll be including in my Substack in the near future. But here's the point. He was very much concerned because the person who received the most votes to be a delegate to the convention, the Constitutional Convention in 1787, was naturally George Washington. But second was Patrick Henry. He's received more votes than, Madison, Edmund Randolph, and all of the others many times over. And his power and his influence really worried the people of who were Federalist and who were monarchist. You know, they called themselves Federalist, but they were monarchists from the beginning. Your thoughts, dear lady?
Right. Well, I didn't know the split started so early on, but, you know, also important and something we don't learn in school and everyone should learn is about their own state governments and the way they were formed after the Revolutionary War and how they were formed and who formed them, because a lot of that debate that went into those state governments, of course, is going to go into the debate about the Constitution. We kind of forget that after the American Revolution, you know, like New York had a somewhat government during the Revolutionary War that was sort of functioning. But then after the war, it was time to create, a more robust state government. And that, of course, is where we get Alexander Hamilton and Isaac Ledyard debating over how powerful that government should be and how it should be structured. And then that debate, you know, kind of gets us into the debate over the Constitution. I don't know if anybody in school learns about very much about their state governments. And, you know, their state governments ought to have been the most powerful government for them and not that distant federal government, right? Your state government should have been your dominant government to ensure, you know, the best possible future for your state. And which was the reason, you know, I mean, there's a few things in the Constitution that, you know, were a good idea. And one was that the senators should be selected by their state governments, not elected by popular vote, but selected by those state governments. People then would be more interested in who was in their state government and the activities of their state governments. And then senators would be held to a level of responsibility to their state, as they could be removed if they didn't represent their state according to the wishes of their state government. When we changed that about 100 years ago, senators now are like, what? They're loyal to anything except their state, you know, wherever the money's coming from.
Well, the one person that I would like for you to, and we're coming up on the break, and so we'll probably do it the second hour. Can you comment in any detail whatsoever, ma'am? I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but can you comment to Robert Yates' relative, Abraham Yates, also of New York?
I can a bit.
Okay, well, I'll look forward to that because Abraham Yates is one of my heroes.
Ah.
Freebird, we'll be back on the other side, folks.
The secret to aging like fine wine is in the vines. Ciroc grape seeds and skins contain high levels of flavonoids and resveratrol. Fermentation breaks these organic compounds down into smaller molecules, penetrating these therapeutic ingredients deeper into the skin, delivering faster and more effective results. Our handmade fermented skincare products are formulated with all natural ingredients and do not contain any phthalates or parabens. Similar products can cost as much as $180. At Natural Earth Medicine, we source our ingredients from local Arizona vineyards and cold process our oils to ensure that our customers receive the highest quality product in its purest form. Learn more at our website and try our fermented skincare products today. Visit naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.